Resources of Ways and Means and resume the testimony that we were having yesterday. Jen Dennison, who is the director of the Governor's Advocacy Office. Jen, welcome back.
Thank you.
Sorry we ran short of time, but I'm glad you're back so you can complete your presentation.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. When you call me back, you get the full meal deal, so you may get more than you want. Just a brief overview of what we talked about yesterday. We talked about the three programs in my office, which are the Ombudsman Services for all the DHR divisions and programs, the Children's Ombudsman, and the Public Policy Dispute Resolution Program. Our Ombudsman staff have more than 22 years of experience as Ombudsman. We have backgrounds in medicine, law enforcement, personnel management, and social work. We have Ombudsman staff who are assigned to specific divisions and programs and have areas of expertise in those programs. Two of our Ombudsman staff are. I provided to you a copy of our, you are on page, because I cheat and put extra things in here, so I see myself. Page 35.
35, thank you.
We have a handout that's our intake form when a citizen contact is made to us, and it's broken down by screens for your convenience so you can see what happens when a citizen calls. The first screen that you have in front of you is provided information of client information as well as the caller if they are not the same person. It also includes information on their client data, which would be if they're recipient of services from DHR. That's the number that we can find them in our system. A lot of our callers come to us by email or through our website, and at the top of the page on the left side, it shows whether it's sent by email, letter, phone person, or the website. The second screen is specific to services to children and families. I'm sorry, the second screen is all of the DHR division, which would be we check a box depending on what the issue of the citizen's concern is when they call. The keywords, which shows at the bottom here, is our keyword so that when we do a report, we can put information in here that talks about, in a synopsis, what the citizen's concern was. If it's an incident of threat or violence, we indicate that here. And there's also a box over here that has repeat or threatened so that we can track for our branches and the divisions as well as central office the incidents of threat and violence to our office. This screen also allows us to capture information on the division branch, the worker involved, so if we need to call a worker, we have information right there to make contact. The third page is the SCS screen, which is information specific to a child that we may need if we're looking into that situation, whether law enforcement is involved, the court, if it's an open case or a closed case, or if it's something that assessment needs to be done and we can get information to the branch. The last screen shows the action that we've taken. So it just helps us stay on track and not miss any case. It gives each of our ombudsman staff a report of how many cases are open or closed and need to have action taken place.
So, Jen, if a legislator calls and asks for your help, similar, you would be able to help with the SCS issues, for instance, and then just get back to that legislator or...
Right, Madam Chair. We can let you know what's happening without giving you in-depth specifics on what's happening with that family. And if you will notice, there is a screen. It's the first screen. Actually, the second page in your packet. There is a box where we check legislators. We check that box. It's in the third column. We check that box, and then we can enter the legislator's name and a phone number so that we have your numbers to get back to you. And in our keyword section, we'd write down the name of the legislator and their staff person so that we know who we need to speak to when we make that contact back to you.
Madam Chair.
Senator Fisher.
Are you against plagiarizing this form?
Madam Chair, Senator Fisher, feel welcome.
Our own use.
Feel welcome. It took us 9 years to have it evolved to this point, so you're welcome to borrow anything you wish.
Well, Madam Chair, I haven't found anything, you know, that's really too adaptable for the things that we do, and we made a couple of attempts at time, but this is superior to anything that I've seen. So.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Okay, and let's go back.
potentially actually have a box for legislator, but I do know that I certainly get a lot of calls about issues related to children and, you know, usually divorce follow-ups and that kind of thing. But I just wondered on this other box up here, we have type of caller, repeat or threatening. Does that, do you have to check that for everybody who calls, or are we all either a repeat caller or a threatening caller?
Madam Chair, Representative Strobeck, thank goodness, no. That's to help us. We get a lot of callers who make personal threats to us, to a legislator, to the governor. Some are very creative in what they threaten to do. Sometimes these folks appear personally in our office. It helps us to be able to track that. It also helps us when we get a report from one of the field officers of an incident that happened in the field. We can cross-check it with ours so that we know who these people are. Sometimes it's folks who have serious mental illness, and we need to connect them to local services. So it's a real good way to connect them where they need help.
Madam Chair, what is your telephone number, Jim?
We have a toll-free number, 1-800-442-5238.
442-5238. 5238.
Okay. Our direct line is 945-6904. Okay. And last week I had one of my staff deliver a packet to each of your offices that showed all the state ombudsman programs, telephone numbers, and contact people. So somewhere floating around, that information is waiting for you.
Okay. Thank you.
Could you repeat that one more time, that 800 number?
1-800-442-5238.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. I wanted to share with you just briefly an incident that took place last week where we had a gentleman come into our office. It was early in the morning. I was the only staff person in our work area at that time. The gentleman made it to the fourth floor. We try not to let the world know exactly where we're located because of the threats we do receive. Our receptionist called and made staff aware he was there. I agreed to go out and meet with him. Our staff do not meet with walk-in people by themselves. Since I was the only one there, Doug Wilson, our director of program and finance, was available and stood by while I met with this person. The name the man gave when he entered the building was not a name that was known to us. But he did give his address as Windsor Castle, the Queen, which was a real good clue. He was in the wrong place, seeing the wrong person. when I met with him, he was a person that had dealt with in the past and had some serious issues. My assumption was he was still incarcerated. He was not. We took care of his needs while he was with us. He left our office and came to the Capitol. By the time I made contact with Capitol Security, he was here in the Capitol kiosk. Before he left the Capitol, he was talking on his soda pop cell phone, and he lit a fire on the front steps. So these are folks that when they see us, the odds are they're going to come and see you too. So the information we capture is very helpful to the state police and folks who need to help and get the help they need. Unfortunately, this type of behavior is part of our reality every day.
So, if you don't mind my asking, is this person somebody who's insane, somebody who has known mental health problems and should be institutionalized? Can you give us any idea about folks like this? What are they? Just mischievous, deviant people that come in to make trouble, or does he have a serious mental problem that really should be addressed?
Madam Chair, this person does have some mental health issues. He is not an insane person. Our task dealing with him was on a child abuse issue, and that was the reason for incarceration. He does need mental health treatment. He is getting it. His parole officer is working to see if he makes the connections now, because we made contact with his CO when he visited the Capitol in our office. So he is getting the help he needs. A lot of the folks who visit with us are just angry, and mental health issues are fine. They're just angry.
Okay.
Yesterday, when Lenny Bjornson spoke here, he talked about the CPT program and how the threads connect throughout communities. We like to see ourselves as the same way. We're real visual about how we connect programs and services as folks. The picture that Gary brought in from Pope County was a real good example of how we connect people to services and programs, too. An example is the Lifespan Respite Program. It's been a lifesaver for us because many times folks call us. They really need those services. They don't qualify for state programs. That's a place we can direct them to get help. Our staff don't believe in turning people away without some kind of resource, and there always is something for everybody. You just have to figure out, okay, what can we do to help this person if they don't qualify for any of our services? We have lots of stories we could share with you. Someone makes you cry. Someone makes you sick. Someone makes you very happy. I wanted to share a couple of happy ones with you today. We received a call from a family about their three-month-old infant who was in need of open-heart surgery. The family was enrolled with the Oregon Health Plan. Somehow, services had been interrupted with the health plan, and they had been told the surgery that was scheduled for the child was going to be canceled because the child wasn't covered. This was a life-saving surgery, and we were very concerned that it had been canceled. As our ombudsman staff looked into the issues, they found errors had been made. She worked with staff to correct those errors. Surgery took place, and the infant's life was saved. We received a note from the family that said, "It's so nice to know there are people out there who really care. You are now considered the start of our family. I will keep you informed of our baby's progress. Again, thank you. Words can never express how we feel for all that you did for our family. You are wonderful." We had a disabled young woman with kidney and cardiac problems, and she was in need of dental care. She needed to have her teeth extracted. They were rotten, and they placed her at a high risk for serious infection that would be life-threatening. She was not eligible for the Oregon Health Plan because she had Medicare benefits. There were no state or federal programs to assist her, so we sat down and thought, okay, what can we do to help this young woman? One of our staff said, let's call the Kidney Foundation to see what they can do. And we found that if you're registered with the Kidney Foundation, there's a $500 year grant for everybody registered with the foundation. As we explained the situation and the urgent need for this young woman, they provided a $3,000 grant for her dental care. So it was a real happy ending to a story where there were no resources that we were aware of at the time. We had a 70-year-old woman who was a greeter at Walmart. She was severely hearing impaired. It was jeopardizing her employment. Her only insurance was Medicare. Doesn't cover hearing aids. As we staffed her situation, we thought, you know, the Lions Club provides eyeglasses. I wonder what they do about hearing aids. And guess what? She now has hearing aids. To better serve the public and others, we've asked assistance from our Ombudsman staff to find the computer programs that would assist us in the best way to have access to client database. We now have LEDS Accessibility, which is the Law Enforcement Data System, BASIS, which is the FTF Client Data File, FRAS, which is the AFS Client Computer Record, and other electronic information to help us assist our clients. LEDS Access has proven to be very valuable to us in a short time. Our staff receives threats, as I told you, from the public. Fortunately, not every day, but at least once a week. We deal with folks who have serious mental health issues, others who are extreme emotional pain and react in unpredictable ways. We perform a computer cross-check on persons of interest between all of our DHR client data records and LEDs. In some instances, we've identified alias information and connections to other persons that have assisted law enforcement to apprehend a wanted person. Yesterday, I told you about the adults who've been arrested for prostituting the children in their lives that led to an arrest and the children in child protective custody. We work with the Department of Justice Domestic Terrorism Task Force to share information on people who make threats against us and other government agencies. Some of these individuals are members of the Posse Comitatus, Constitutionalists, and the Militia Movement. They are well known to the task force. Some of you may remember that I served as a Deputy Citizens Representative for Governors Roberts and Goldschmidt prior to coming to DHR in 1993. Having worked as a governor's staff person and a DHR staff person, one of the things I find most valuable is the access to client data information that you can't access when you're outside of an agency. This has allowed us to really provide personal and intensive service and assistance to the public. It's probably the best thing that we can do for the folks who call us is that we can actually look in the screens when they call, see what's happening in their situation, what they might be eligible for. Our staff have access to all the policy information for the divisions within our agency. When we're assisting one of the clients that calls, because we have access to the policy and procedure manuals in our office, we're able to take a look and see, did that division follow its own policy and procedure providing services to the public? If they did, it thumbs up, great job. Public, you're receiving the services to which you're entitled. If they didn't, it gives us the opportunity to talk to the division and their staff about ways we can improve service to the public. We see ourselves sometimes as an extension of your office to assist you and your staff. We appreciate the calls that we do get from you that allows us to assist you. On page 37, you have a policy package that talks about the establishment of 3 permanent positions for 2 ombudsmen and 1 administrative support person in our office. These positions are currently limited duration positions, and they're funded through an interagency agreement from the Commission on Children and Families for the Children's Ombudsman. In 1996, I was confirmed as Oregon's Children Ombudsman through that interagency agreement. The last of our programs is the Public Policy Dispute Resolution Program, which is on page 36. Last legislative session, the legislature approved court hiring fees to be raised to fund 3 additional public policy dispute resolution programs. One of these positions was housed in the Department of Human Resources. This was not my decision to make, but it was one of the wise decisions I think Gary has made in placing that position in our office. The connector between that person and our staff, because we can identify public policy disputes that are going on between cities, counties, and states, or maybe between state agencies or division programs, and we can provide the information to connect to those coordinators to do an assessment to see, do we have a dispute program that we can do an assessment and put together a program. The people who are in the human services cluster that this dispute resolution coordinator serves are the DHR Division and Programs, the Commission on Children and Families, Long-Term Care Ombudsman, Commission for the Blind, Disabilities Commission, and the Psychiatric Security Review Board. This position does not provide person-to-person dispute or mediation. It is a multi-party dispute, and it is a public policy process. This year, that position person assisted SCF with the design of a statewide termination of parental rights mediation program. He assisted in the development of the DHR confidentiality policy. They provided dispute resolution system design and assistance and other technical assistance to the cluster agencies. They created an alternative, or ADR, forum for the human services cluster agencies. And we developed an electronic case management system, much as the one that I showed you with the client data screens. We've developed a similar process to collect the information for our dispute resolution programs. What I hope you have heard from my testimony today is that all of our staff have a common goal of a sincere passion for their work in providing service to the public. Even on the days when we feel at great risk of harm and are very frustrated because we've not been able to provide the citizen with the desired outcome, we love our work. Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions?
Madam Chair, I don't know how many of the members have had an opportunity to work with Jim and her crew, but I have had several occasions to do that. And when I have literally exhausted everything that I had any ideas about or anything, I've consistently come up with answers, and good answers, and quick answers, and I have really appreciated that and looked upon that as a kind of a court of last resort. And I try not to bug them anymore than I have to, but they've been excellent resources for my constituents.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator. Let us see your first resort.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Bob Mink, Deputy Director of the Department. And Jim and her staff do a great job. And one of the things I just wanted to emphasize about that is they report directly to Gary and me. And so infrequently, sometimes we have staff that don't want to cooperate with her. So what she does when that occurs is comes and gets me, it gets Gary, and we make sure the staff cooperate. So that's an important component of her role here, is the direct report to Gary and me. And like I said, we're very, very fortunate to have her, and I'm glad she's a member of our team, because we've identified lots and lots of things that we have improved as a result of her inquiries. Next, we're going to talk about information systems,
okay.
And that's the largest part of our support services budget. I'm going to invite John Cuddy to come up and join us. He's our chief information officer, and he knows much more about this than I do, but I would just like to tell you a little bit about John. Yeah. John. John's our chief information officer, as I said, and he's very well suited for this job. And the reason is, not that many years ago, he used to hold a similar job to mine in Pennsylvania. He was the deputy director of the Pennsylvania Department of Human Services. And after that, he held Gary's job in Ohio. So he was the director in Ohio. And after that, he worked for several different computing companies and consulting companies. And we sold him away from Deloitte & Touche. It's been 5 years ago now,
almost.
And so John has assembled a very, very good management team, in my opinion. And what he's done, what we charged him with, was take seven different data processing environments within the Department of Human Resources, which were going their separate ways and really not talking to one another, and trying to make that a cohesive unit with the same vision. So that's what he's been working on since the beginning, and I think he's accomplished a lot, given the complexity of our organization. So I'm going to turn this over to John right now and let him describe what we do.
Good afternoon. For your record, my name is John Cuddy, and I'm, as Bob said, DHR's Chief Information Officer. And we've stuck a last tab in your notebooks, and what I'm going to do is sort of walk through that particular set of pages and try to give you some feel for what we've done and where we're headed and some of the issues we deal with and some of that. I think if when I finish, if I'm successful in telling you the kind of things that I'd like to tell you, I hope that you'll understand three things when this is all finished with me. One is the size and complexity of information systems in DHR. DHR, is, as you well know, is the largest department in Oregon government and the most complex, and it's not a coincidence that the information systems of various sorts that serve the department are also large and complex, and hopefully you'll have a better understanding of that when I finish. Another thing is that this is a critical resource for the delivery of DHR services, not only for delivery of services today, but also critical to where Gary wants to take the department in the future, and I'll talk a little bit more about that in a few minutes. And finally, I hope that I can give you some feel for a couple of things that we've asked for money and policy packages that I believe and I think Gary and Bob and others believe are essential to the future work that we need to do for the department. And I'm going to talk about those a little bit, too, related to the year 2000 and our efforts to improve the ways that we support people who use our systems. As Bob said, the Office of Information Services was created in January of 1966. It was a consolidation of seven different data processing shops that the each individual division had maintained for some years. And it was done for a number of reasons, partly to accommodate a growth in information services systems, service needs. The needs of the department have been growing and continue to grow. And it was believed that we could do a better job of accommodating that growth from a centralized organization as opposed to these seven different divisional ones. Also, it was, I believe, an effort to contain costs, and I think we've done that in various ways. Just for instance, we've actually slightly reduced the amount of money we spend on our wide area network, which is the network that connects our offices all over the state, and have had a two or three times increase in its capacity. And some of that is because of a new contract that the Department of Administrative Services put in place during this time, but some of it is because we were able to take a more consolidated view of how we hooked our offices together. And I think also this was done to parallel the creation of a more integrated department. And so if you're going to create a more integrated department, you need a more integrated support service, in this case information systems, to support that departmental integration. And while this wasn't planned because we were not into year 2000 at that point, we were just about to begin thinking about it and planning for it, I think in retrospect it has been essential to our ability to successfully deal with our year 2000 problems is to have this ability to work across the divisional lines and to have a consolidated organization to do that. What we have up here and on the next page of the presentation on page 106 is a chart that's sitting up here on my left. Give you a little sense of some of the size of this. We've got 500 network connections. We've got somewhere around 7,500 or 8,000 personal computers, 350 servers, about 180 to 190 local area networks that we support all over the state. And we've got almost 13 million lines of mainframe programming code of programs. We'll talk a little more about that when I tell you about year 2000, because we've had to go in and examine those lines of code and fix them. So, and we'll talk some about that. We have a large mainframe that is in the employment building, and it handles about 3.2 million online transactions a day. That's when somebody out around the state sends information into the mainframe or gets information back from it. That number, when we were created in January of 1996, was about 1.8 million. So that's grown. I didn't calculate the percentage, but it's grown substantially in the time that we existed. And we produce about 500,000 checks a month, and we have 80,000 tape cartridges. Those are not too dissimilar from the they're cassettes essentially, although they're larger than you would use in your audio tape deck or something. But we have 80,000 of those tape cartridges that we have to manage in our computer center and that contain data. And get used as part of our production work over there. Another thing that, if you can put up the next one, John, for me, I mentioned 500 network connections, and this was a chart that I would have, if I had reduced it to 8.5 by 11, I would have had to supply you all with magnifying glasses. This is,
as it is.
Yeah, as it is, it's pretty crazy. This is a chart showing the connections of our network all over the state. And again, it is very big and very complex. And there's not much more to say about it other than sort of which, when we produced this thing not too long ago, the other thing I said was, wow. And it's big and it's complex. And it's something that connects all of our offices and ultimately all of our users around the state back into our mainframe here in Salem, as well as in the local offices. We connect them with each other through the what are called local area networks.
John, what is the sort of a cluster over on the right side? What does that represent?
I'm not sure, Madam Chair. Do you know, John?
Okay. That is the mainframe?
That's the employment building. That's what comes into the employment building.
And what's the middle dot then from which, those long lines go to?
Gary's off.
That's the mainframe.
Main driver? In the employment building. Madam Chair, that's the main, what's called a router, which is the specialized computer that routes transactions. That's the main one that's in the employment building. We do have people who understand this. I don't, in that sense of knowing how it's set up. Okay. Just moving quickly on to page 107, our budget. What we're asking for in terms of our base budget is essentially the same in the upcoming biennium as it is now. We're expecting to spend about $35 million this biennium on year 2000, which is the column on the left, the 35.3. We're asking for $14 million more next biennium to finish it up, and also for $4.5 million, I'm going to talk about these in a little more detail later. About $4.5 million to improve our support for our users around the state. Our systems are used to do a whole bunch of stuff, and I put down here at the bottom of page 107 a few highlights of kind of generally the sorts of things we use them for. People all over the state use them to manage cases. We pay providers, Oregon Health Plan providers, other Medicaid providers, in-home providers through for SDSC's clients. Those sorts of folks. We produce our client benefits, food stamps and cash assistance and that stuff. We use them to help manage our institutions around the state, and we produce reports that managers use and that come to you and that go to the federal government to help us get our funding and help them monitor and evaluate what we do. And again, we have another chart up here, which I don't propose to go through, but it gives you a little bit of a sense. It's also reproduced on page 108, a little bit of a sense of some of the ways that our systems are interconnected. Again, it's a complex environment with our systems internally feeding information to each other, as well as to we exchange a lot of information with outside entities, local governments, a number of our providers, and other states, and not-for-profits, and so on. But that gives you a little bit of a sense of some of the systems that we operate and how some of them are interconnected. That's, in a very quick nutshell, our current environment. This environment is changing. It's partly changing because of the things that Gary Weeks has, and others have been talking to you about that Gary wants to do for the department related to his themes of partnerships and greater integration and focusing more on outcomes. And not only does information systems, as I said, do they play a key role in what goes on today, but they're also going to play a key role in supporting this transformation of the department. And we've had a number of activities going on that are meant to give information to Gary and ultimately to us about how our information system should aid in that transformation. And we have, the department has a local government advisory committee, and they have put together a vision of what they would like information systems to look like 10 years from now, and we've been out testing that around the state and talking to local people and trying to get a feel for how that plays out in greater detail to give us some good information to use in our own planning. And we've also been doing a lot of internal planning and what we call DHR of the future, and there have been some workshops held recently and I believe some more planned on into the summer related to that. And also we did, particularly last year, a lot of field visits ourselves and actually went out and talked to people in our local offices and talked to community partners as well about essentially the question that I asked them. I went on a lot of these, most all of them. The question I asked them is what's working well and what's not working as well as it should that we can work to improve. And we got a lot of really valid and valuable information from that. And it was it was very useful for us to do that. And we're taking all that stuff and trying to put it together to help us understand how information services should help with the transformation of the department. I'm not going to propose, unless you'd like me to go through every one of these things on this chart on 109 and over on 110, but just a couple of them. Historically, we've had separate divisions providing separate services, and what we're trying to move toward is integrated services and the concept of no wrong door for our clients. And the challenge that we have is trying to create integrated data, data that crosses divisional lines, which it has not done historically, at least as it's available for the most part to our users, and making it available to support those integrated services. The last one on that, on page 109, we've historically done a lot of our service delivery ourselves. That has over time been changing, where services are now provided more collaboratively, working with community partners. And what we have to do with that, our challenge is to figure out ways to provide new systems ultimately to support that, but also to give community partners and even some of our own people in one division access to systems across divisions and information across divisions. And we don't have a standard environment out there for our community partners. Every county makes, as our divisions used to, every county makes their own decisions about how they're going to use data processing. They make decisions about what equipment to buy, what software to use, how to use it, what networks to use, and so we do not have an environment around the state which is standard, and so when we start reaching beyond the walls of DHR to make this information available to community partners of various sorts, it causes us some significant problems, and that's a challenge for us to try to figure out a way to get past that and overcome that. Also, the environment that we operate in, sort of within the department, is changing. As we said earlier, we've had division-based information services in the past. They're now consolidated and centralized, and frankly, one of the issues, and we in fact just talked with Bob Mink and some other folks about this earlier today, we have to do is we have a lot of competing priorities in the divisions, and when one division says we need this, another division says we need something else that may or may not be compatible, we need to balance and figure out how to handle those competing priorities. We've also had traditionally until recently what I will call a stable technical environment. We've had a mainframe with what are called dumb terminals or terminals without any intelligence hooked up all over the state. We now have mainframe. We have a centralized mid-range computers that use the Unix operating system. I'm going to try to stay away from technical stuff for you today. We also have local area networks with PCs attached to them. We have software that's constructed by our users themselves in our local offices. We have software that runs in our mainframes. We have software that runs on servers, some of them centralized, some of them around the state. It's a much more complex and dynamic technical environment than it had been for 20 years.
Mm-hmm. Need a little education, I guess. Mainframe seems like that's an old word, been around forever. Is that still like the old mainframes? Do we still need mainframes? How has this technology gone with that?
Madam Chair and Representative Loken, in my opinion, yes, we do still need mainframes. Mainframes are still the best way to process large amounts of information, large quantities of data that they handle best. What I have said since I came here, and we've really tried as a department to do this, is that we have an array of tools available to us, PCs, computers that are bigger than PCs, mainframes, and what we need to do is figure out the best tool to meet our needs. Sometimes it will be a mainframe, sometimes it won't. But there was, now what's this, 1999, 10, 12 years ago when client server stuff and PCs really started to take hold, people said, oh, the mainframe's dead, you can do everything on a PC. Well, that's not true. And I think people are now swinging back to the idea that, yes, you've got a lot of other options to the mainframe, and sometimes they're appropriate, sometimes they aren't, but for a place this size, mainframes are always going to be there, I think, for us. And the other thing, we have a major, major investment in these mainframe systems and in the software that runs on them, and it will cost tens of millions, if not hundreds of millions of dollars to replace those and take, it would cost, and take them off the mainframe.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think we've either got the money or the will to do that. So I think they're here to stay, but what we're trying to do mm-hmm. is take advantage of some of the newer technologies whenever it makes sense to us to try to take advantage of their capabilities but still retain and leverage the investment we've made in our mainframe.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Okay,
let's see. I think that I said initially that the need for our services was growing, and I mentioned the number of transactions that run on the mainframe. Our help desk, which is a centralized telephone support, by telephone support group that somebody calls up anywhere in the state, a user who has a problem, and the help desk either deals with the problem or gets it to the right person who can fix it. We originally staffed our help desk to handle about 2,000 contacts a month. And I say contacts because now some of the contacts come in by electronic mail as opposed to telephone. We are getting about 4,500 contacts a month in our help desk. This is an example of how the need has grown. Also, we're being continually asked by the divisions, and I want to emphasize to you, we are a service organization, and we don't set these priorities. We get the priorities set for us. They tell us what we need, and we try to advise them about how technology can help them. but they are continually asking for new capabilities for the systems that we have, or sometimes new systems, to help them do their the work of their business, their programs, to help improve how they can do a better job of serving their clients. So we do have a growth coming from that. The inclusion of partners that I mentioned a few minutes ago, the more we extend beyond the walls of DHR, the more need we're going to have for greater services to incorporate and in some way include those partners in our activities and make information available to them, give them access to our systems, share information with them, share planning with them, and some of the things that are up on the top of page 110, as we get into more of that stuff, there's going to be a greater need for these services. And finally, the department, as I've said, is changing, and the human services delivery system is changing, and it's asking for more consolidated data, greater public access, and information to support service integration, which you've heard about over the preceding weeks and, I guess, months from various people from the department about what we want to do with service integration. Well, then the question becomes, how do we sort through all these service needs and set priorities and figure out how to meet what Gary and the divisions are asking us to do? And again, I want to say we don't set the priorities. The business entities in the department define their business needs, and then we work with them to try to figure out how technology can help to meet those business needs. What I want to do, and I'm going to go through this, I hope, pretty quickly, is just talk to you for a little bit about how information services work inside the department to help meet these customer needs or these needs that have been defined. In the planning, we have a number of things we do related to planning for information systems. There is a statewide enterprise information technology strategy, which an organization, the IRM Council, that is chaired by Don Mazziotti, who's the state's chief information officer, works for DAS. They have put this together, and we are involved in putting it together and are making our planning comply with what that strategy is calling for. I mentioned the Local Government Advisory Committee vision. We also put together every 2 years an Information Resources Management Plan, a so-called IRM plan, and that's required by DAS, and we do that, do it for each biennium. We prepared it last fall for the upcoming biennium, and we really lay out what our objectives are and what our needs are in our various divisions and for our various programs, and what we plan to do with information systems in the upcoming biennium. We also have ways of doing priority setting internally in the department. The DHR cabinet is involved in that. We have a group that consists usually of deputy administrators, that's our information systems steering committee, and then individual divisions, if they have needs that are sort of theirs alone, also do their own priority setting internally for what they want us to be doing. Basically, either the department or a division identifies their business need. That's driven sometimes by what you folks do. You may require us or ask the department to do something. We get federal laws and mandates that get put on us. We have program changes. Again, we're working to work more collaboratively within the department, working to improve our outcomes for our clients, better measurements of performance, working with partners. All these things may involve program changes and changes in how services are delivered, and all those can create business needs that could be helped by technology. I remember here, three or four months ago, we were talking about somebody was proposing to automate something. And we were in a meeting, and Bob Mink was there, and a person sort of made this proposal, and I said, well, why do you want to automate that? And we talked about it, and Bob said, now let me make sure I understand something. Am I hearing the department's chief information officer saying we should not use technology for something? And I said, you bet, because technology is a tool. Just like a whole bunch of other things we have, sometimes it's appropriate, sometimes it isn't. And what we're trying to do is be responsive to those business needs and not drive them. And often in the past, technical people in organizations like DHR and in the private sector were driving technology rather than having the technology be driven by the needs of the organization. We're trying very hard not to do that in DHR. We get involved, they talk to us, we try to look at costs and benefits and what are the alternatives for meeting a business need, pros and cons, that sort of stuff. We get into what Representative Loken asked about a couple of minutes ago, and that is it appropriate to put it on the mainframe or on a personal computer or to put it in one of our client service systems? We try to consciously make that kind of a judgment. Moving to 112, we also look at how feasible it is to apply technology. We look at the scope. How big is this thing? Is it a monster that is going to eat us up and we'll never get anything out of it? And we've had a few of those, I'm sorry to say, in this state and in many other states and in the private sector. Although in the private sector, we don't hear about them as much because they don't live in the fishbowl we live in, but they're there. We take a look at what kind of resources we're going to need to apply, how long it's going to take, and try to make a reasonable decision about is this something we really can get into and make work. We have a whole bunch of approvals we have to get through to get this stuff done. We have a lot of internal DHR stuff, of course. We have legislative approvals that we get. We get approvals from the Department of Administrative Services, both their purchasing people, if we're going to do contracting, as well as their Information Resources Management Division, which basically says, is this something the state ought to be doing? We often, if it's federally funded, we have a number of federal approvals we have to get, and we have to go to the Department of Justice to get them to look at often our contracts and things of that sort to make sure that they're legal. So we have a whole bunch of approvals that we need to get done before we embark on something. We have, when we go into obtaining a new system, we have a number of options for how to do that. One option is to transfer something from another state, and I put here on the presentation in the middle of page 112, with caution. Some of you may remember the Child Support Enforcement System called CSEAS, C-S-E-A-S, that the department started in 1991, that basically failed. We had a contractor who didn't deliver, and we ended up throwing them out about 3 years ago, and they were a little more than that, almost 4 years ago. But they were transferring a system into Oregon from Maryland, and it didn't work. And so I say transfer from another state as an option, but we have to do it with a great deal of caution. One of the successes we've had doing that is a system called ORCA, which serves the Vocational Rehabilitation Division. And that one came from Washington State. We brought it in, implemented it, and are made changes to it. They like it. It replaced the mainframe system. It helps them with case notes and tracking expenses on a voc rehab case, and saves them a lot of time in the counseling process. They've done studies of how this has saved time for their people and enabling them to do better jobs of dealing with those cases. Another way we can obtain a new system is we can contract for a service. And with electronic benefits transfer, that's what we have done. We produce data that goes to a company outside the state, and they make available food stamps and cash assistance through a swipe card, or something like we use for credit card or whatever, through an ATM type of card, which is used in either an ATM machine or in a grocery store to provide food stamps. And that has a lot of advantages. It gets us away from paper food stamps and paper checks, which can be forged and stolen and all that sort of stuff. Helps to reduce fraud and abuse. And we can deliver benefits quicker. If we've got somebody who has an emergency food stamp, we potentially can have them food stamps available to them the next day. That's being handled by a contractor. We actually send them the data, and they provide the service to us. Another way is we can have a contractor actually help us build systems. And, you know, some people think that you ought to take this information services in government and privatize it and have a contractor do all the stuff. And while certainly that has some appeal, we've also found that we've had some significant failures when the private sector has tried to do work for us. I mentioned CSIS. DMV was essentially done by a private sector, which was hit the papers here about 3 years ago. And I would suggest that it's not black and white that a contractor ought to do information services. They have to be carefully monitored, and you have to keep a close eye on them. We've had some success having contractors do work for them. One of them is Oregon Access that was implemented in 1996. That's a system that primarily serves SDSD and the AAAs that SDSD works with around the state. And it automates a lot of intake and eligibility processes in SDSD that had been previously done manually. And they've improved their eligibility work by about 30%, and helps clients, many of whom have trouble getting to their offices. It reduces the needs for clients to visit their offices, and that's been a good success for them, and ultimately for us as providing that service. Another example where we've got a contractor building a system for us is our new WIC system that supports the WIC program that will replace a mainframe system that does not meet federal standards. And as I think you know, WIC is paid 100% to the program by the federal government. And we're expecting to implement that in the summer of next year. Another way that we can acquire a new system is to build it primarily ourselves. And an example of that is FAFIS, which Jen Dennison mentioned a few minutes ago that she has access to. And this is basically a system to support our child welfare program and helps with investigating suspected child abuse and helps with substitute care and adoptions, ultimately adoptions. That piece of it is still being developed. And it ultimately will allows caseworkers to spend more time with children and their families, less time on the kind of repetitive administrative tasks, which is why you automate things in the first place. One of the things that I'm painfully aware of as I'm sitting here talking to you about this stuff and probably boring you to death because we're talking about a lot of sort of high-level things that are happening here in Salem. I have asked Alan Biddle, who is works for SCF in Polk County, to just take a couple of minutes and talk to you about how he and other people in SCF actually use FAFIS to help them improve delivery of services to children. I thought it might just be helpful for you to get a little bit of firsthand feel for how one of these systems, and I could have asked somebody to come in and talk to you really about any of these systems in a similar way, about how these systems really help us do a better job dealing with clients, which after all is what DHR is about. So with that, if it's okay with you, I'd like
to ask
Alan.
Good afternoon.
Talk to you.
Madam Chair, Senator Keith, members of the committee, it's a pleasure to have been asked to come here and tell you how this is working in the field. I've been with SCF now for 20 years. I started out in Klamath Falls 20 years ago, and at that time we were tracking clients, cash referrals and things like that with a kind of a library card drawer, 3x5 cards. You'd pull it out, you'd go through this manually, the workers did, and we would see if when we received a new referral, if we'd had a cash on that family before, or if there were a number of referrals. That system worked, and we were real pleased with it because that's all we had at the time. The problem was we only knew about those cases that had come in through that particular county. When I moved to Yamhill County 3 years later, they had the same system, although at that time a system called IIS was coming in, the Integrated Information System, and that was the dumb terminal that Mr. Cuddy referred to earlier where the clerical would access and you could get some limited information at that time. And that got better and better, excuse me, as the years went along. As Mr. Cuddy testified, to FAFIS was introduced in 1996, brand new. It was taken by staff right away, for the most part, as something new and innovative and very helpful. And FAFIS is a Windows-based system. One thing I liked about it, it's in color.
Yeah.
I'm very color-oriented. It overlays the mainframe information that you were asking about earlier, Representative Wilson. It overlays that mainframe information comes up to the workers, but it's much more interactive. Staff interact with that themselves. Each worker now has, each social service specialist has a computer, PC, on their desk, and they can access FAFIS 24 hours a day and actually enter a lot of the information themselves now and pull it up anytime they need it. And what I wanted to do was just give you some examples of how we use FAFIS in the branch. And this is true of all branches. I have worked in Klamath Falls, McMinnville, Salem, but Marion Branch, and Polk County, where I'm now a supervisor. And for a while, I was the quality assurance coordinator for Western Region SDF, where I did branch reviews, the comprehensive branch reviews that were mentioned yesterday. So I know that how FACES is being used in other branches, not just in Polk Branch. The main person in a branch who uses FACES right now is the intake screener. All of the calls we get, whether from law enforcement, walk-in, or by mail, calls from schools, we write up what we call referrals or intakes on the main screen of FACES. As soon as that information is entered and logged, that information is available statewide that this referral came in on this family. That information is then transmitted to a supervisor for assignment for a protective service worker to follow through. The nice thing about this system is that information then stays in the system and we can access that historical information regardless of when it came in, anywhere in the state. It's nice to be able to access this historical information. I mentioned the cost catalog earlier. Many times we wouldn't find out about a family's past history until days after the intake, when that's what we have, even with the old IIS system. We know that in just a matter of seconds now, minutes. The narrative information that's put on that protective service intake, why that call came in, what the protective service worker did with it, is then entered. It's there. We can access that immediately. I had a situation yesterday where a worker I supervised learned that an 18-year-old mother with a two-month-old child had moved to an Eastern Oregon county, and she knew where this young girl was living. She wanted to know about the lady she was living with because this girl up and moved without asking permission. We pulled the name of the lady up that she said she was living with, found out that this lady had an open case with SDF and that her three children had been removed 3 months previously for drug and alcohol and domestic violence issues. So we knew that within 10 minutes of learning where she was. We were able to then call the worker, because the FACES also tells us who the current worker is. We could call that worker in Eastern Oregon, ask her to do a welfare check on the baby, and the information I have now is that family is on its way back to Polk County where they need to be. That would have been very difficult to do previously. Another instance or another example would be if a mother in Mount Hear County, say, and I'm picking the farthest way example I can get, if a mother in Mount Hear County absconds with her child, that worker can, we call it red flag, or put an alert on the face sheet, the screen that comes up when you pull up that name, that this mother is on abscond status. If she is referred or something comes up in an AFS office or SDF office, say in Polk, Marion, any other county, that alert pops right up in front of you. It's right there that somebody's looking for this mother and this child. I, as a supervisor, can monitor workers' caseloads right away when we're doing conferences. When you're doing your weekly or monthly conference with the workers, we're talking about cases. I can pull it up while we're talking, make sure the goals and services are up to date, addresses are current. We can change addresses. The workers can write on the screen. John talked about the help desk.
Yeah.
Sometimes we think it's the help desk. The help desk. We talked about the help desk. And they're actually on the screen, if you've ever seen FACES, on the screen there's a little button up there that looks like a bug. And if you cursor up to that button and push it, it opens up on email, boom, right there to go to the help desk. And you can email a problem right to the help desk. And they respond to you very fast. Like I said, we can change addresses. We can add or delete family members, only electronically. If somebody moves in or out of a house, we can add or delete them. We can note there's a screen for noting family resources, whether it be church, relative. If the case transfers to another county, this is on that screen, and all that information is right there for the new county. We monitor foster homes, which children are in there, how long they've been in there, where the foster home is, any special problems with that foster home, problems that they're especially able to deal with kids. We do our TCM. Targeted case management documentation now on FACES. TCM, targeted case management, that's, I don't know all the details, but it's responsible for a lot of the federal money that the state gets for services we provide for children in care and out of care. We used to do that longhand on paper and little yellow folders, I remember, and workers would have to take the time. If they had a large caseload, lots of time was spent every month writing down services they provided. that now pops up on FACES. We can get that done electronically very fast. I had a worker, to take you out of state for a minute, I had a worker come back from a one-week vacation to Los Angeles this last Monday, and after counseling with her as to why she chose Los Angeles for the vacation, we got down to, she used to work down there, and she met with some coworkers, and they got to talking about ex-coworkers of hers about similar systems in L.A., and the workers down there were just amazed that we had a system that could track information and families statewide and the variety of screens we can pull up on FACES that allow us to do that. They made the statement to her, and she was telling me this, just very amazed, they lose cases and kids down there because of their quantity of cases, number one, but number two, their inability to effectively track them with whatever system they were using.
I don't know if I am or not. I'm going to talk about privacy. Okay. Where did you get the expertise to design this wonderful system that we have? This FACES system. Was this?
I will defer to Mr. Cuddy.
Okay.
Madam Chair and Representative Loken, all of the systems that we design and that we develop and have put in place of all the things on this list all have heavy user involvement, and so the design work of this was basically done by people in FCF, and they defined what kind of features they needed in order to do their work.
You design the type of program you need, kind of information you want to generate, and then you have the expertise to build it.
Yes.
You mentioned the DMV problems. And my question is, I don't know why the private sector wouldn't be able to do that, but I would think that in having private sector do this, you would have to have someone directing that effort from the state who is very knowledgeable themselves, or you're not going to come up with the system you want. I'm not sure that would be the private sector's problem, maybe not as much as the one that's handling it, managing it.
Madam Chair and Representative Loken, I didn't mean to imply that we wouldn't have, that the state would just hand it over to the private sector and say, go do it. Clearly, we have to have that kind of oversight and definition of their work. Mm-hmm. The only thing I was meaning is that it's a complex decision as to how much the private sector should do versus how much state should do, and we have to keep a careful eye on how those decisions are made, and it's a lot more complicated than it appears on the surface, and you have to be very careful that you define your needs and you monitor what the private sector does for you to make sure you meet those needs. And I wasn't saying one way or the other it should be private or it shouldn't. It just was a caution that the private sector has messed up stuff for us, and we've messed up stuff for ourselves, and it's not a simple thing.
Yeah. No, follow up. But the point I'm making is that I think the mess up can come if we in state government, whoever is directing that, is not informed enough to direct the private sector.
Absolutely.
Adequately.
I would.
And but I think both areas work, but. I think it's good to look at costs and what is going to be the most cost-effective and provide the quality system that we need. Sounds like you've done a great job with FACES. Is that the way you pronounce that?
We call it FACES.
FACES.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
That's
kind of rough.
Yeah. Mine was a different question.
Yeah.
I was, as you were talking, I was struck with, how efficient you've become in getting information about people from one area to the other. And so it brings this shadow in our minds about Big Brother watching you and how that feels to the people involved. Do you, have you known of instances or are you concerned about erroneous material or damaging material getting hooked to somebody in these records and then just staying there in a way that might be damaging to them in the future?
Madam Chair, Representative Ross. Yes, we are concerned about that, and we before a case, the new intake, the intake screener that puts the information on the screen, before that is logged and sent on, we do double checking on names, addresses. We have a way, FACES is much more efficient now at searching the mainframe database to make sure we get the right name and the right family, if there's been previous contacts, because in many cases we have same name people out there, different families. And then we do have, there are processes through OIS available. If we do enter erroneous information, we can change that. Mm-hmm.
Well, I know the Judiciary Council, the Judiciary Committee Council, Bill Taylor, said that his name is a fairly common name. He's found that there are people who have his name that have done some stuff for which he doesn't want to be blamed. So it is really, you have to be careful to get the right name and address with the right person.
And send it. I kind of want to ask a related question that's coming at it from the other angle, and that is, how is this information, or is this information available to state police, for example, if they stop somebody or they're investigating something, would they be able to have access also to this screen, especially the, you know, the red flag screen that pops up and says this is a person that you know, has some needs elsewhere, or somebody that they should follow up with?
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative Strobeck, that information, to my knowledge, is not available to the state police. However, they don't have the same access to the VHR mainframe that we do, is my understanding. But that if a person is on abscond, using that example, there is a warrant to the police. That warrant is made to, or that request for pickup order is made to the police and the courts in that county, and then the alert is on the screen.
Okay. So they'd be able to see it in their system. They'd be able to see it in their system in the form of an outstanding warrant, mm-hmm. but not have access to your data.
Okay. We would see it if they came in for to open a case for benefits, or if a new protective service referral came in.
Okay. Thank you.
The other thing that I heard you say, which isn't one of the questions that have been asked, but it did occur to me, with the advent of this more efficient system, and the fact at one point you said that not as much paperwork is done, for instance, by the caseworker, they can do a lot of this right on the computer. Now, if that takes less time, I guess this would be true. And what I'm about to say is, if they spend less time doing the paperwork, that means they can spend more time on their cases. And I think, are we reducing our caseload? Is that my understanding, that somewhat our caseload is being reduced? So if we can do it more efficiently and our caseload is lower, can we also reduce the size of our department?
Madam Chair, Eric and Kelly, here at the Department of Administrative Services. Some of our caseloads are dropping. In this particular instance, this caseload is not dropping. These are caseworkers that go out and look at potential abuse and neglect. And if you look at the chart, it's actually increasing. But there are areas in this department where the caseload is dropping. If you'll notice, when we get through this phase of the process and get into the rebalance or whatever, you'll see that there is a reduction in staff as a result.
I'm sorry. I got to ask that question.
You don't put that answer.
Yes, I hope so.
Madam Chair, we have staffing standards for most of our caseloads. So as the caseload increases, we ask for more resources. As the caseload decreases, we ask for fewer, or we reduce our resources.
But that brings my question now. If there were more responsibility with writing things out by hand and handling a lot more paper that took more time, if it did take more time, that's my emphasis here. It might be more efficient in some ways, but I know that having computers has not necessarily made our work easier. What it's done is made us expect more and faster. But if it was more efficient and took less time, are we reducing the standard for a caseworker and how many cases they should have and that sort of thing? I guess that's kind of my my question is, are we keeping track of what really is the right number of cases that a caseworker can have with the advent of technology?
Madam Chair, not only technology, but different ways of doing business, like in adult and family services, where the scope of the jobs have changed dramatically. What they have done is redefined what the caseload standard should be. Mm-hmm. So we don't do this on a year-to-year basis, but as we see that the structure of the job has changed, then we relook at the caseload staffing standards. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Or I should say the department looks at them and we watch them.
Madam Chair, committee members, I have just a couple more thoughts.
Okay.
And then I'll let Mr. Teddy take over. It seems like what I've been talking about is yes, we are more technologically advanced. But to me, all that means is that we are storing information more efficiently and we're transmitting it more efficiently. It hasn't really cut down. Actually, it's increased the amount of information we're able to store.
Yeah.
It's what is happening. In my opinion, there's been three technological advances that have been responsible for what I would consider a faster, more efficient response to child abuse, the provision of service to these families, and the documentation necessary. One is SAFER, which has really been the Family and Child Information System has been really a boon to what we do as far as knowing our clients and families statewide, and I hope I was able to get that feeling across to committee members. Two is email. The telephone is nice. The telephone's always been with us, but email, you've documented what you sent. You know it's there when you're dealing with another office, another worker. And then the last one is word processing. The word processing technology that we all take for granted now is really nice. After we made the change from workers going from dictating to typing in their reports, now we've got special directories on our computer systems in the branches where we store all the case information. And I can pull it up as a supervisor and look at it. I don't have to go to a file and search through a whole bunch of documents. I can find it right there on the screen. This would not work without support, all of these. And I wanted to just say this about support. There, in the rollout of FACES, when FACES came out, there were bugs. It was a new program. We had downtimes. We had upgrades. It reminded me, I feel better when I think of Bill Gates when he rolled out Windows 98 a year or so ago and it went down on him when he was showing it to people. We've had similar experiences, but overall, 99% of the time, FACES has helped us with what we do. The support we get from the Office of Information Services, OIS, has been great. I mean, they're fast, they're efficient, they're friendly. Sometimes they're harried because, you know, when a large system goes down, there's a lot to do, but they get it fixed and it works. I checked with workers before I came just to make sure that I'm not just talking as a supervisor. You know, my glass is always half full, people have told me. And they're happy. They like it. It makes things easier and faster. And I've always been impressed, and I think Mr. Cuddy alluded to this earlier, I've been impressed with the fact that when they make changes, field is included in that. There's always been a committee or a phone call or something like that where they've asked, does this work? And we'll tell them, this doesn't work, or this is a problem, or this is slow. And then the next rollout, there's been a change. So there's been a fix on that. I just wanted to close with a paraphrase, if you will, of a bumper sticker I saw recently that I kind of enjoyed. The worst day with our new technology is far, far better than a good day without it.
Okay.
And I'd be happy to answer any questions if you have others.
No other questions? Thank you very much, Mr. Bibble. I appreciate you coming and telling us about this, and I saw you here waiting yesterday, and glad you were able to come back.
Oh, I enjoyed waiting.
Thank you.
It's been very informative. Thank you.
Okay.
Madam Chair, I want to tell you and the committee that commercial message at the end was not prompted by me, although I appreciate it. One last one I want to mention. Kelly talked about AFS and how they've changed their, at the bottom of page 113, AFS and how they've changed the way they do their work is TREX. And this is a system that automates the case narratives for AFS, and it really now promotes their goal of client self-sufficiency instead of what they have done traditionally in AFS types of organizations, which is promote the old goal of making people eligible. TREX eliminates a lot of paperwork and especially allows sharing of information between caseworkers and between community partners. And in fact, TREX is being used in several of the service integration sites around the state as the system to knit together those different divisions and community partners who are working together in the service integration model and tracks as the system that supports that. Turning to the next page, 114, when a business need is identified and we go through all this priority setting and internal and external approvals and get it funded and so on and so forth, we then actually get into developing a system, and whoever develops it, whether it's us internally or a contractor doing it for us, has to go through the same general process, and that is we refine that business need and turn it into a computer requirement, and we design the system, we do the programming, we do testing, a lot of testing if we're smart, and we implement it, including training our users in how to do it. And then what we have is something that relates to one of the policy packages I want to talk to you about briefly, and that has to do with how we support it after it's been implemented. And a lot of times, unfortunately, in the development and implementation of information systems, the after the post-implementation support is one piece that has often been given short shrift, where we commit all of our time and our money and our energy and enthusiasm and everything else to getting this thing out there, and people start using it, and then a lot of times we fall down in supporting it after it's out and in operation. And if you really are going to support this thing, you've got to set up a way to not only make changes as users, and as Alan said, when they identify stuff in the field that can make FACES work better, they tell us, and we have a whole process for making those kind of modifications. But also, if users have problems using the system, we have some different levels of sort of low-level troubleshooting where the users themselves, if they're well-trained, can answer some of their own questions. We also have in each of our offices local area experts, we call them, who are people who may part-time carry a caseload or, depending on the size of the office, may do this full-time, but they actually have expertise beyond what a user would have, and they act as sort of the first line of defense in the local office to help deal with problems. They can also help frame a problem if it comes in to our help desk, which is our intermediate level of support. They can frame it so the help desk can know either how to answer it themselves or where to send it sometimes. And then we have some specialized technical support, which our people here in Salem and some around the state bring to bear on fixing if a local area network goes down in an office. We may have to bring somebody in who really is more technically skilled to deal with that. So we have a sort of tiered level of support depending on the severity of the problem that we apply after the system has been implemented. And as I said, I'm going to talk about a little bit more about that in a couple of minutes. Finally, the key ingredients for success, and I mentioned this a minute ago, heavy, heavy, heavy user involvement. You've got to have your users involved in these systems, telling you what they need in the first place, telling you what's working and what isn't, helping you make changes to improve them. And if you don't have that, and they have to be involved in the testing as well, if you don't have that, I guarantee you the chances are real good that your system's not gonna work the way you want it to, and may in fact even fail. We also have to have good project management. The Department of Administrative Services, and with my applause, has instituted some project manager training that we've been sending a number of our people to, and a lot of the agencies around the state have been doing the same. That's really excellent because it's really needed. And you have to have adequate resources, and frankly, that at some stage of the game is where you all come in when we ask you for the money to do these things. And we have to have realistic expectations. We can't build one of these let's throw everything but the kitchen sink into it kind of systems. They have to be manageable pieces where you can get your arms around them and make sense. And if you don't have all those ingredients for success, you're really taking a big chance that you're going to have a failure. And we've had our share here and many other places. I mentioned earlier that I wanted to talk about some essential future work, and the obvious big one is to continue our work on year 2000 and finish that. In the old days, I'll pull out one of my props here. In the old days, we used to use these things to put information on. They're called SAB cards or IBM cards. They're also called Hollerith cards. And Herman Hollerith was a fellow who worked for the U.S. Census back in the late 1800s. And he actually developed this as a way of improving the counting for the census. And it was first used in the 1890 census. Been around a long time. This thing holds 80 characters, 80 numbers or 80 letters on one of these things. This thing, which I'm sure you've all seen, which is a diskette that goes in a PC, holds 1.4 million characters. So in the days when a lot of these systems were developed, including many of our big mainframe systems that we've had in operation for 20 and 25 years, this was what you were using to store information or to write programs on, and storage was very expensive and not easy to come by. It was limited. Memory in the computer was limited and expensive, and so programmers took shortcuts. And so they made a year, two digits, 69, 72, 98, instead of four digits. So now computers have the potential, when we get to the year 2000, to think it's 1900 and all kinds of funny things can happen. One of our people, Robert Green, who manages our networks, talking to him several years ago, and we were getting heavily into our work on year 2000, he said, "This isn't any big deal for me." I said, "What do you mean?" And he said, "Well, we had a problem. We had a decade change." And he said it was so scarce, but he started out in information systems, that when they went from the 60s to the 70s, they were using one digit for the year, and they had to adjust everything to go up to two when they went from the 60s to the 70s. So, but that's, again, an instance of how expensive and difficult and limited the memory and the storage capacities were back when a lot of these systems were first developed. So we've had a major effort, both on our mainframe and in other areas, to fix our year 2000 problem. Started 44 months ago. It will be a 44-month effort by the time we wrap it up in March of next year. We started working on it with our planning in August of 1996, and including ramping up and ultimately ramping down, we'll be at it for nearly 4 years. It's, as you can imagine, an organization the size of DHR and the complexity of DHR, it's a very, very large effort, and I want to emphasize this. There are still a lot of unknowns. We are sailing into uncharted waters on this stuff. Nobody's ever done this before, even though Robert Green did it between the 60s and the 70s with the decade. We've got a lot yet to do between now and March of 2000. We're doing quite well, but we've got a lot yet to do. At the peak, this project is going to have 120 contractors, or does have, I should say, and about 70 of our own staff working on it. It's in total going to cost us almost $50 million as a department. That's total funds, but still it's an awful lot of money wherever it comes from. We have set up a factory process to deal with our mainframe systems. And I've just given you a little diagram here at the bottom of page 114, where we actually pull our systems into, we schedule them as to when we're going to fix them. We pull them into inventory. We do some baseline testing to understand how they work now. We fix them, the so-called remediation. We then do a whole bunch of testing afterward to make sure that when we had the hood up and made the changes, that we didn't mess something up. And we have to compare the testing after we did the remediation with our baseline testing before we started to make sure the system still worked right. And because of that chart that we showed you earlier about the interconnection of our systems, scheduling and the testing becomes that much more complex, because you've got a lot of different pieces you've got to keep an eye on as you're doing all this. It's not just as simple as pulling it in, fixing it, and testing it, and putting it back into production. You've got to coordinate it with a bunch of other work you're doing. We have what we call user analysts going down one side, who are people, again, from our divisions, who understand the business that those systems support. And they help us make sure that when we do our testing, that we're testing for the right stuff, both before and after. And we have what we call our application experts, who are our technical people who manage and maintain those systems on an ongoing basis during normal times. they're out there working on the project, many of them, to make sure that they understand how these systems are built, to make sure that when we go in and make the changes, we pick up all the places where dates are dealt with and that we don't mess things up when we make the changes. So those are the kinds of people who work on this. Over on the next page, just to give you a little sense of how that...
Before you run to the next page, I've been following the Y2K discussion in DHR ever since I've been on this committee. But I just have a question to make sure my ignorance. Is there any way in which the connection between DHR's computers and so on and the federal government or banking systems or anything like that can be affected by Y2K? I mean, you might have everything perfect. What about other places? Is there any way that those interactions could create trouble within our own system?
Madam Chair and Senator Shields, the answer is absolutely. There are ways that we could have problems.
So it's not only our systems, but it's the federal government, banking systems, and so on that have to keep pace with what we're doing.
We have an enormous number of organizations, private sector, federal government, counties, not-for-profits, healthcare providers, so on and so forth, with whom we exchange information. I'm going to talk a little bit in a couple of minutes about some of that. And we exchange that information by what are called interfaces. And we have to, as part of our testing, do an enormous amount of work to test those interfaces and coordinate with them to make sure that the information that we send them, they can handle, and vice versa. And as I said a moment ago, we've got an awful lot of unknowns, and one of the big sets of unknowns is those interfaces and whether or not they're going to hang us up because of something we can't control. You're absolutely right. That has a major potential to cause us problems, and we've therefore allocated a lot of resources to do the testing of those interfaces.
Somehow, Madam Chair, I wish I had as much faith in what some of the other entities were doing.
Right.
What we're doing.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yes. And Bob has just reminded me that we do have edits of data that comes into us and things of that sort where we're looking at it to try to catch it. But you're absolutely right. That is a real potential hole in this thing that we've got to be prepared for with some staff or around to cover contingencies that may come up because of that. On page 115 at the top here, we have tried to lay out some percentages of the effort, and you'll notice that baseline, which is the baseline test that we do before we make the changes, and the testing that we do after we make the changes, constitutes about 70% of the effort. It is absolutely essential that we do this amount of testing in order to make sure this stuff works right and we don't mess something up when we fix these things. But I want to also say that year 2000 includes an awful lot more than just fixing our mainframes and our mainframe systems. It includes the mainframe hardware itself, the software on the mainframe, the operating system for the mainframe that's equivalent to Windows on a PC. That has to be worked on. All the interfaces, the interfaces between our systems, as well as all those externals with outsiders. We have our client-server applications. We have to work on our network, both our wide-area network that connects our offices around the state and our local-area networks that connect users within our offices. We've got, as I said, somewhere 7,500 to 8,000 personal computers that have to be tested and potentially replaced. The many of our personal computers are already Y2K compliant because we have been moving to a new desktop operating system called NT, which stands for New Technology, which is Microsoft's next product after Windows 3.1, Windows NT. We've been moving to NT. Most of our computers are already there, and they will be year 2000 compliant. And we will have to replace some of our computers, particularly some of our older ones that are that use the 486 chip. The 486 machine will not run NT well, and particularly it won't run NT in a networked environment where we have a lot of things going on at once, where somebody on their PC has email and FACES and maybe an access to the mainframe, as well as word processing going on all at once, the 486 machines will not work properly in a networked environment. Some of them won't work, period, with Y2K, but we do have to replace them for Y2K. So we're going to get our personal computers ready. We have commercial software that runs in our personal computers, like WordPerfect or Microsoft Word or spreadsheets, that has to be looked at and potentially some of it replaced. We have a lot of what we call user-developed applications. These are spreadsheet applications that somebody's developed on their own PC. I remember I was in one of those field visits that I mentioned earlier that we took last year. I was last summer in a SCF office in Eugene and was talking to a group of workers, and one of them said that she had a spreadsheet that she used, a spreadsheet application that she used for about 80% of her work, and it had been developed and put together by somebody who had left them 3 years earlier. She said she didn't have any idea how it worked. She said if she had to make any minor change in it, it was terribly difficult. We've got a number of those things around that people use for their jobs. We're going to have to look at those. We also have something that we're engaged in right now that I think Dan Hall is going to talk to you about shortly. Well, I got to finish here. About business continuation planning, and we need to plan for possible problems with our interfaces or other things that could cause us difficulties around the first of the year. And so we have support of that to do as well as part of our Y2K effort. I'll go through this quickly. We have a lot of, let me just say this. Currently, we are on schedule to get this work done, and I don't see any reason why we won't get it done on time, and our mainframe mission critical applications are going to be done in August, and the rest of them done by the end of the year, and the rest of these things I've put a schedule together at the top of page 116. But we still have a lot to do in the first 9 months of the upcoming biennium. We've got to continue testing stuff related to our mainframe. DAS and Testmasters, which is our oversight contractor for year 2000, both want us to do more testing. The Federal Healthcare Financing Administration, which oversees our Medicaid program, came in, did a review of where we are with our MMIS system, said we're doing fine, but they want us to do more testing. So we got to do a lot of that. We have to continue to do a lot of testing of those interfaces that Senator Shields mentioned with outside partners. We have to support our business continuation planning. AFS is considering, they haven't made a firm decision, considering issuing food stamps a few days early in very late December instead of on January 1st, so we don't run into a potential problem there. The federal government, by the way, is considering making some of their payments in late December instead of in early January for similar reasons. And
okay for a month.
Pardon?
So we'll be okay for a month.
Yeah, okay, exactly, yes. And we're going to have to make system changes to be able to do those kind of things, and then we're going to have to change the systems back to the normal operation. So we've got work to do there. We need, we believe, to have some contractors available to us for contingencies in case we run in the unexpected things. As I said, we're sailing into uncharted waters, and we still have some remediation of some of our business critical and non-mission critical mainframe systems that are going to be going on after the 1st of July. We have to do continue to do work on our desktop compliance, testing of personal computers, working on those user-developed applications I mentioned, like spreadsheets, and we've got to continue to replace our network operating systems on our local area network. So we've got a lot yet to do. We're on schedule. I'm happy to report to you that I'm comfortable we're going to make it, but we got a lot yet to do, and we need the money to do it, hence the budget package that we're asking for. And the other budget package is that one of the things that those field visits identified for us loud and clear last year is that we need to continue to work, do a better job of supporting our users when they have problems. And so we've asked for a package to improve that, to get us better training for those local experts out in our local offices, to get more of them, to do some better training of our help desk people and increase their expertise so we can solve more problems there, so we can have our really high-level technical people able to focus on the high-level technical problems because they're the only ones that get to them. And we need to do some better coverage around the state for some of our high-level technical people. So we have another package asking to improve that as well. And with that, I think I'm about to get the hook that's going to pull me off the case.
Uh-huh.
If there's any questions I can answer, I'd be happy to do so.
Okay. If there are no questions for John now, I'm sure he would be available for other questions at another time.
Absolutely, anytime.
Appreciate it, John. And if we do have questions, we'll come and talk to you. Appreciate your work.
Thanks very much.
Madam Chair, of course, the big question is what happens if the electricity doesn't work, what happens if the telephones don't work, and what happens if something happens to our computer system. So, and we have with us right now Dan Hall. And remember, I talked yesterday about facilities. We have 134 facilities we need to manage. Well, he's the guy that manages the leases. And we've also put Dan in charge of coming up with a process for each of those 137 field offices. What are we going to do if we have a crisis of the turn of the century? So, Dan, we'll go through that process, will you?
Thank you. Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Dan Hall, and for the record, I'm the Director of Facilities for DHR. This is going to be about a five-minute overview of the business continuation planning that we've done, and I'll tell you up front, we're on schedule, and we're due to have this done by June 1st. Right now, we're in the process, as Bobby mentioned, business continuation planning is looking at how do you continue to provide the essential services to your clients in the absence of computers or telecommunications or electricity. And it's what we've done early on since last April, or last summer. We've had a group of people from all the different divisions looking at all of what we consider the mission-critical business functions, as well as some of the less critical ones. Initially, this kind of looked at the systems themselves, and then it moved to the business functions, but they've identified and prioritized what we consider the 16 broad mission-critical functions that we do as a department, and those are the items that we're addressing in our GAS business continuation plan that's due on June 1st. Examples of this are primarily related to how do you, in the absence of your computer systems, for example, how do you determine a client's needs if they come to your office and say, I need emergency cash assistance, and how do you get that assistance to them? It could be emergency cash, it could be food stamps, it could be medical assistance, any number of things, but how do you provide those services to your clients in the absence for example, all the systems that John is working on if they fail for some reason? What we're doing right now is we have all of our field offices, 134 field offices, Bobby mentioned that throughout the state, working on their own field office business continuation plans. It's what we've done. We sent a packet out to them, described what they had identified by division as their mission-critical business functions, and our response at the division level, how, for example, in AFS we're planning to issue food stamps early, mm-hmm. or how you would do cash assistance. In a lot of cases, these come down to manual systems. In the absence of the computers and those things, you would end up with manual systems. And we're asking each of the field offices to plan how they would do their staffing, what are the resources they might need. For those offices that share common office buildings, we have 49 of these buildings are common office buildings. We're asking those divisions to get together and coordinate how they would deploy resources within that building, share resources. Also, by geographic area, we looked at all the offices outside of the major metropolitan areas, which are basically Portland, Salem, and Medford in our system, and asked those offices by geographic areas to come together. For example, in Albany, you have three offices. Have them get together and decide how they would share resources and redeploy if necessary to continue to provide services in the absence of these things. Those field office plans are due back into us this next week. Those roll up into division-level plans, and those come into us to the department, and we'll provide an overview. We'll also address critical things as to how are we interfacing with our external partners. We're not doing the planning for our partners, but it's important for our partners to understand what we're doing and collaborate with them to some extent. And right now we're prioritizing these partners and identifying who are those we need to meet with. We're also talking about communications and how to communicate what we're doing with our clients, for example, if we're doing things early. With our employees and with our partners. So those are all issues that will be discussed in the department level plan. As was also mentioned earlier, after this is done on June 1st, we're going to do tabletop exercises. And these are basically painting a scenario for a situation and asking our different offices and at the division level and department level people to respond to it. And basically the people going through these tabletop exercises are not the same ones who prepared the plan. We're getting those other people involved to see how these things work. And we're spending June, July, and August doing this, and at least we'll find if things don't work as we thought they would, then we can go back and change things a little bit. But that's the purpose of the tabletop exercise. So we'll have that process finished by the 1st of September. The other thing we're looking at that's related to this, you've probably heard of the embedded chip issue, and these are chips that may be affected by the change in the date. And these certainly affect facilities. Throughout our offices, the 134 offices we have, field offices are lease offices, and staff sent a letter out to all of the landlords. We're working with the landlords to do a very complete inventory of all the different types of systems that could be affected in those offices. It could be things such as HVAC systems, security systems, fire alarm and suppression systems, all those types of things that can function in an office. We want to have a very good understanding of those and make sure that those have been addressed, and if not, then we can go back and make sure they're addressed. So we're inventorying all of those right now. In our health divisions, we're going to inventory the equipment in our lab, testing the lab equipment, making sure those things are right. And in addition to that, we're even doing some of the other things that people in the offices ask questions like, what about my copier? Or what about the fax machine? And those are basically standalone analog types of systems, and they're not affected by the embedded chip issue. But that's all work that we're doing right now that will be complete shortly. What hasn't been corrected, the other one is telecommunication systems. A lot of the different offices have their own switching devices, and we've gone through and done a very complete inventory of those with gas communications. Of the 134 offices, there are about a dozen now that haven't been upgraded yet, and they're upgraded by the start of June. So we feel very comfortable with the process we're going through there. And that's basically it.
Great. Well, after June, if we're still here, check and see how some of those tabletop things went. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Okay. Are we ready for Kelly?
Well, I think that's why we need to do this thing real fast.
Oh.
Doug, can you do?
Okay.
And Madam Chair.
Or if we could do this Monday.
Well, or if you want to, I just gave you the display summary. It's the same thing that I hand out to everything. Everybody, if you have questions, you can also.
Okay.
Madam Chair, I know we have one unit left in the department, and that's my office, and which is accounting and personnel and some of the budget coordination. We can easily do a few minutes on the beginning of Monday's meeting, which I think is rebalance the schedule, because Gary and I will be in front of you again, and we can also give Kelly a chance at the same time, because he will probably be at his seat on Monday afternoon over there, too.
If it's all right, why don't we just do that?
Okay.
We only have 3 minutes. There's no reason to.
I wanted to say why you still have a majority of the committee, Madam Chair. We've been at this for 12 weeks, and I wanted to tell you, as well as all the members of the committee, how much I appreciate the courtesy and the respect that you have extended to my staff over the last 12 weeks. This is my 13th session. I've been in front of a lot of ways meeting subcommittees, and you've given us a very fair chance to lay out the governor's budget. I know we've got hard discussions to go in the work session, but I need to tell you that I do appreciate how generous and patient you've been with my own folks here. I haven't experienced that all the time in 15 years and stuff, and I know it's hard because you have to make hard decisions, but I do appreciate the courtesies you've extended to all of us. So.
Well, thank you. Your staff has been good at answering any questions that we have, so we appreciate that.
Okay.
Thank you. Madam Chair, maybe you could just give us a little preview of next week. So we can.
Next week we are going to begin the DHR rebalance. That's what we're going to be doing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's
how
on the schedule. Mm-hmm. For, I think, the entire week, maybe longer.
I don't have the revised schedule with me, but there is another rebalance on the schedule for 2 days.
Oh, is it?
Okay. Okay, so maybe the Tuesday is rebalance. You have the same one.
Oh, okay.
I haven't gotten a revised schedule.
We'll begin with rebalance. First of all, what we'll do on Monday is we're going to have the remainder of the directions.
Yeah, Madam Chair, what I've been told is Monday and Tuesday's rebalance, and then the remaining is really looking at the 9901 budget and work session.
Okay, so we have work session the rest of the week?
That may not be. So, at any rate, we will be back here Monday. We will be doing DHR Monday. And we will adjourn for today. See you Monday.